We now hear the legal perspective from Mr. Carl, who's otherwise known as Ed Holderly III, attorney at law, of Draheim and Pransky, attorneys at law of St. Louis.
Thank you. In the United States today, the right to procreate has largely been taken for granted and certainly hasn't received the legal attention or recognition that we've seen with regard to the avoidance of procreation. As a result, there's a lot less statutory and case law on point in this area, and therefore, even though there are significant issues involved in the right of procreation, and particularly when you're dealing with assisted reproductive means, there is not the law available to guide couples seeking to bear children through the use of those assisted reproductive means. What I'd like to do today is to look at three methods of assisted reproduction: artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization, and surrogacy, and discuss briefly the law which exists with respect to each and how it impacts on couples seeking to bear children by the use of those means. I'd like to start first with artificial insemination. Of all the reproductive techniques, this one has been in use far the longest, and the legal status as a result is probably the most developed and most clear. As Dr. Rader had indicated, artificial insemination can involve either the use of the husband's sperm or the sperm of a donor. However, from a legal standpoint, the major issue is the legitimacy of the child, and therefore, since the child born through the use of artificial insemination using the husband's sperm is the natural child of the couple, the legal issues are not nearly as great, so we'll focus on the use of artificial insemination involving donor sperm. As recently as the 1950s, the use of artificial insemination with donor sperm was characterized by many courts as being adulterous. And as recently as the 1960s, children born through the use of artificial insemination with donor sperm had to be adopted. They were considered illegitimate unless adopted by the donor the recipient's husband. Although artificial insemination today is widely practiced, it's been estimated a few years ago that it may result in 20,000 or more births a year. Only 34 states have so far adopted statutes addressing this procedure. While the statutes in those states that have adopted them differ, there is a significant degree of basic uniformity with respect to the matters regulated, and there's complete uniformity in those statutes in the purpose of the statute to legitimize the children born through the use of artificial insemination. The Uniform Parentage Act is a proposed model statute that's been developed by the National Conference on Commissions on Uniform State Laws. And Section 5 of that uniform statute deals with artificial insemination. In the handout you picked up today, one of the items there is that statute, if you'd like to refer to it. In addition, you also received a copy of the Uniform Status of Children of Assisted Conception Act, which also deals with assisted reproductive technologies on a much broader basis. These are proposed model statutes, and as such, they aren't the law in any state, but are only intended to provide guidelines states or state legislatures that are considering adopting legislation. Of the 34 states I've indicated that have adopted some form of artificial insemination legislation, at least 16 have adopted a version of Section 5 of the Uniform Parentage Act, or UPA. Therefore, I think that a review of Section 5 of the Uniform Parentage Act is a good starting point for considering state laws generally. Basically, the Uniform Parentage Act establishes a number of basic points. The husband of the woman who is artificially inseminated by the donor sperm will be considered the father if there's a consent of the husband and the insemination is performed by a licensed physician. In addition, the statute goes on then to provide more detail, requiring that the consent of the husband must be in writing, must also be agreed to by the wife. The doctor must certify the signature and the date of insemination. the consent must be filed with the State Department of Health. The statute also goes on to clarify that the donor of the semen, or the sperm rather, if it's provided to a physician for artificial insemination of a married woman, will not be treated as the natural father, so it eliminates the legitimacy problem. The other Uniform Act that you also have in your handout imposes far less requirements and basically says that, or assumes that, a husband will be the natural father of the child born through the use of artificial insemination, unless he, within a period of 2 years after the birth, contests the lack of consent. As of this date, though, only two states have adopted that, a form of that statute. At a minimum, all 34 of the states that have adopted legislation have intended to legalize the result which is intended by the parties using the artificial insemination process, and therefore they deem the husband of the married artificial insemination recipient as the natural father of the child if the procedure is performed by a licensed physician. In fact, although we don't have guidance in all of the other states, case law in many of the other states would indicate that a court would reach the same conclusion even if the state doesn't have a statute on point. As I'd indicated, the Uniform Parentage Act and most of the other state statutes impose at least three basic requirements, those being marriage, the woman must be married, consent of the spouse of the woman receiving the procedure, and performance by a physician. While these are all certainly legitimate and valid requirements, purely from a legal perspective, care still has to be used so that you don't create a situation where a husband can later deny parental responsibility by a technical loophole of not meeting one of these requirements. One point on one of these requirements, and that's the requirement of performance by a physician. Sperm donorship is a much easier and more common procedure than egg donorship. There is not the medical screening, generally speaking, regarding sperm donors. And one of the reasons put forth for physician involvement in the process of artificial insemination is the expertise in assessing the health of the sperm donor. But it's interesting to note that while most states now seem to require screening for sexually transmitted diseases, and a few require screening for genetic diseases, there are only really two states that would require the physician to obtain an extensive health and genetic information screening and retain those records with respect to the sperm donors. And as we recognize the importance to the child born of the artificial insemination process of having a complete health history in the event of problems in the future, and even the benefit to the artificial insemination recipient perhaps of knowing the origin of the sperm, it becomes a more significant legal issue, I believe, for states to consider imposing further requirements on the physician performing the process so that we can have this kind of history available. The next area I'd like to touch on is in vitro fertilization. And here is a caveat. I've got to say that I'm going to talk about in vitro fertilization in a very general sense. Obviously, there are many techniques and procedures that fall within that broad category. The law to date has not made those fine distinctions, so you'll have to take my comments as such. In vitro fertilization raises many problems similar to those raised by artificial insemination, although there are more issues raised because now, in addition to sperm donorship, you also have the possibility of egg donorship, and you have the possibility of the embryo that's created from the process being gestated by a party other than the husband and wife seeking to raise the child. In addition to those issues, I think a separate issue you need to consider when you're dealing with in vitro fertilization is that for the first time, the fertilized egg itself can become subject to direct manipulation, and that raises a number of other potentially significant legal issues. For purposes of ease of discussion as we go on today, I'd like to identify the couple desiring to rear the child resulting from the in vitro fertilization process as the rearing parents, and confine our discussion of in vitro fertilization to gestation by the woman of the rearing couple. We will discuss briefly afterwards some of the issues surrounding surrogacy. In addition, I'd like to separate the discussion of the issues regarding in vitro fertilization into those that are similar to the issues we've discussed with artificial insemination, and separately the issues regarding the status and treatment of the embryo. as has already been indicated today, the first live birth resulting from in vitro fertilization occurred in 1978, and therefore, if anything, since the law moves slowly, we haven't got a whole lot of law on point to provide us with guidance. At this time, there's very little statutory guidance directly concerning in vitro fertilization. But to the extent that there is statutory guidance, the artificial insemination statutes probably provide the closest analogy, but they don't by their terms apply since they're limited to a distinctly different technique. And most of the issues relating to in vitro fertilization are very similar to those relating to artificial insemination. And arguably, the legal relationship between the egg donor, the recipient, and the offspring should parallel the situation with respect to sperm donation, with the respect that the intention of the parties is accomplished and the child born through the use of in vitro fertilization is treated as the legitimate child of the rearing parents. This is the result that's been reached in Louisiana, which, to my knowledge, is the only state that has adopted a statute on point, and we'll discuss that statute in a minute. It's also the result of the Uniform Status of Children of Assisted Conception Act, which you've received, and it's reasonable to assume that as time passes, it will be the position taken by legislatures and courts in the future. Moving to the separate issue, then, of the status of the treatment of the embryo created by the in vitro fertilization process, as I've indicated, this, to me, is the major difference between IVF and artificial insemination. The fact that you now have an ex utero embryo permits manipulation, storage, discard, and other treatment not possible with artificial insemination and raises significant additional legal issues. Unfortunately, again, the law addressing the issues has not kept pace with the technology, and only Louisiana has adopted a statute dealing specifically with extracorporeal embryos. You've also received a copy of that statute. In addition to that statute, there are a few cases dealing with embryos created by the in vitro fertilization process, but not much else. There is some guidance in the fetal experimentation statutes and the cases dealing with abortion and contraception. While they touch tangentially on these issues, don't provide any solid precedents, but only guidance for speculation and analysis. For purposes of our discussion today, from a statutory perspective, I'd like to look briefly at the Louisiana statute and again briefly at the fetal experimentation statutes, and then move on to some case law and look briefly at a few constitutional issues and then one case which deals directly with in vitro fertilization. The Louisiana statute, which you received, deals specifically with extracorporeal embryos, and it considers the embryo created through in vitro fertilization to be a juridical person, that is, a person recognized under the law. And the effect of that is then to clearly recognize that embryo as a life to be protected. The statute goes on and imposes a high degree of care and prudent administration on behalf of the embryo and prohibits its intentional destruction. The statute also limits the use of in vitro fertilization solely to the development of a human being through implantation and specifically prohibits the farming or culturing of embryos for research or other purposes. Also, it prohibits the sale of the ovum or the fertilized embryo. It also indicates that the embryo cannot be owned by the parents or the medical facility, and that as a separate juridical person under the law, the courts are to decide what is in the best interest of the embryo. The rearing parents are entitled either to implant the embryo or to renounce their rights and make it available for adoptive implantation, but the statute's clear that if they choose to do that, they can renounce in favor of a specific party, but they cannot receive compensation for that renunciation. And lastly, in order to legitimate the child born of in vitro fertilization, the statute provides that a constructive adoption takes place when a married couple executes a notarial act of adoption and a birth occurs, which simply means that the couple at the time of implantation acknowledges that they intend this to be their child. The next statutory area we can touch on briefly is the fetal experimentation statutes. Approximately 25 states have at this point enacted statutes restricting fetal experimentation, and some of these are very broad, applying to research with regard to embryos, are containing language relating to any products of conception. Although these statutes were largely adopted in the 70s in response to the Supreme Court's abortion rulings and aren't really specifically designed to prohibit artificial conception and transfer of embryos, they're certainly subject to being interpreted to apply and may prohibit embryo manipulation, cryopreservation techniques, and other processes associated with in vitro fertilization. A few cases have used these statutes for this purpose, and it's not unreasonable to expect that will continue into the future. Before turning to specific cases that I'd indicated, I wanted to talk just briefly about some constitutional law principles, and I'd like to look at the process and constitutional law principles that a court might use in considering a challenge to a statute designed to protect embryos. This consideration requires a balancing of two areas. First of all, the right of a person to procreate by the use of assisted reproductive techniques, and secondly, the status and treatment of the extracorporeal embryo itself. Looking first at the right to procreate, the United States Supreme Court has not directly addressed the use of in vitro fertilization, although the court has indicated its strong support for procreative liberty in decisions regarding sterilization and contraceptives. These cases certainly at least suggest that if faced with a direct limitation on a married couple's right to reproduce, the court may well recognize this as an infringement upon a fundamental right. To date, a court has not specifically recognized a fundamental right to non-coital reproduction, but if it should in the future, how it does so will have a significant bearing on how the court would react to statutes limiting assisted reproduction, such as artificial insemination and in vitro fertilization, as well as statutes designed to protect extracorporeal embryos. Then the second issue in that balancing act is the status of the embryo itself. And I think we need to start by recognizing that even in Roe versus Wade, the court recognized a compelling interest in the state to protect human life, at least during the last trimester of the pregnancy. Subsequently, in more recent abortion cases, specifically the Webster and Casey cases, while the court still upheld the fundamental right of the woman to her bodily integrity and to be free from the gestational burden of childbirth, the court also recognized, or became at least increasingly willing to recognize, that each state can legislate according to its own theory of when life begins. In Webster, the court upheld the right of the state of Missouri to establish, quotes, that the life of each human being begins at conception, and unborn children have a protectable interest in life, health, and well-being. In considering the position which a court might take with respect to a statute designed to protect extracorporeal embryos resulting from in vitro fertilization, one has to remember that the fundamental right of bodily integrity to be free from gestational burdens, which drives the results reached by the courts in the abortion cases, is not a consideration since the embryo is extracorporeal, outside of the uterus. Therefore, the abortion cases are not precedent for a right to destroy the embryo outside of the uterus, which should outweigh the state's interest in protecting the life of those embryos. The Roe versus Wade case says that a woman has a right to remove a fetus from her womb, but it doesn't imply the right to destroy an embryo separate from her body. To draw a conclusion from this, while it's not unlikely that an outright ban on the processes of in vitro fertilization or artificial insemination would probably be viewed by a court as an impermissible restriction on a couple's procreative rights, restrictions designed to prevent the creation of excess embryos or to require the preservation or implantation of embryos that are created would, in all likelihood, be upheld. The most current, I suppose, and perhaps most well-known case involving in vitro fertilization is that of Davis versus Davis, a Tennessee case. It's been fairly widely publicized. It's been through the trial court, the appellate court, and the Supreme Court in Tennessee, and the Supreme Court decision was just published in June. In this case, Mr. and Mrs. Davis had been unable to conceive, and they sought the help of an in vitro fertilization program. As a result, 9 embryos were created, 2 were unsuccessfully implanted, and 7 were frozen for future implantation. Before the remaining 7 embryos could be implanted, however, the couple divorced, and a custody battle over the embryos ensued. Mrs. Davis initially sought to obtain custody of the embryos for implantation in herself, and Mr. Davis asserted that the embryos were property, and therefore he sought to gain control of them and have them disposed of. He didn't want to see the children born. The trial court received extensive expert testimony, and based on that testimony determined that human life begins at conception and that the embryos were human beings. Having reached that conclusion, they then went on to say that the state, as the legal guardian of the embryos, would determine the best interest of the embryos and therefore found them to be available for implantation and granted custody to Mrs. Davis. The case was then appealed, but before it was argued in front of the appellate court, Mrs. Davis remarried and basically changed her position from requesting the implantation of the embryos in herself to making them available to other adoptive couples. The court doesn't acknowledge it, but I have to believe that the results, as we'll discuss them, had to be affected in some way by that change of facts. The appellate court then, without sophisticated analysis and ignoring the extensive expert testimony at the trial court level, rejected the conclusion that the embryos are human beings and considered them only as having a potential to become human beings. Having done that, it then refocused the issue only on who should be entitled to control the frozen embryos. And in doing this, it looked first at reproductive rights and second at Tennessee's legislative acts. In considering the reproductive rights, the court relied on Supreme Court decisions regarding sterilization and contraception and states that the right to procreate is a citizen's basic right and the right not to procreate is also a protected right. Giving the wife unilateral control over the embryos would be tantamount to the court deciding that Mr. Davis would be required to become a parent against his will. The court then went on and, as I said, looked at the Tennessee legislative acts and basically simply noted that under Tennessee common law, life doesn't begin until viability. Under its abortion statutes, there's no legal status of the fetus during the first 3 months of gestation. And lastly, that under the Tennessee wrongful death statutes, there is no action recognized for the wrongful death of a fetus, even if it's viable, unless it's born alive. Based on this analysis, then, they concluded that not until live birth should an embryo or fetus be given full rights as a person, and therefore there's no compelling state interest to justify ordering implantation. Then the court held, it would be repugnant and offensive to the constitutional principles to order Mrs. Davis to implant these fertilized ova against her will, and it would be equally repugnant to order Mr. Davis to bear the psychological, if not the legal consequences of paternity against his will. The court then went ahead and ordered joint custody to Mr. and Mrs. Davis of the embryos. The Supreme Court of, not a great solution, I'll admit, the Supreme Court of Tennessee then essentially affirmed the decision of the appellate court, but they at least had the sense to recognize the potential problems of joint custody, and they went on to at least attempt to give some guidance for resolution of the dispute that was likely to occur. And basically the guidance they gave was this. First of all, in determining a dispute like this, you would look to the preference of the progenitors if they could agree. If they couldn't, and obviously in this case they could not, then you look to any prior agreement with regard to preconception agreement with regard to the disposition of the embryos. If there is none, then the court said that they would balance the relative interests of the parties, and the party wishing to avoid procreation should prevail if the other party had a reasonable possibility of achieving the birth of a child without the embryos. In this case, although it's recognized that Mrs. Davis had a significant infertility problem, the court said she had the ability to adopt if she chose, and therefore there was a possibility of achieving a child by another means. The court then went on and said only if there is no other way to procreate should consideration be given to the use of the embryos. And as I'd indicated, since they said Mrs. Davis could at least adopt, they would not reverse the appellate court's decision. The last issue I'd like to consider then is surrogate motherhood. And because the surrogate is the birthing mother, and also because the law generally tends to favor the bond created between the mother and the child to whom she's given birth, surrogacy poses real problems regarding the parental rights of the rearing parents. While surrogacy differs from traditional adoption situations, the adoptive statutes are perhaps the existing law closest to on point and have been the source looked at by most courts dealing with surrogacy contracts. Many states have legitimizing statutes that are intended to legitimize children born out of wedlock, essentially providing that the child is the legitimate child of the natural parents. But in the case of a surrogate relationship, this has exactly the opposite effect intended. It would make the child the legitimate natural child of the natural mother. Likewise, the artificial insemination statutes we talked about earlier cut the opposite direction and could arguably make the surrogate's husband the natural father of the child born of the surrogate relationship. Thus, generally, if the rearing mother is to be deemed the natural parent of the child, it's necessary for the gestational mother's rights to be terminated and for the rearing mother to adopt the child. The same process may also be required of the rearing father, particularly if, as I'd indicated, the artificial insemination parentage statutes happen to be applicable. The principal purpose, then, of the surrogacy contract is to carry out the preconception intent of the parties and legally bind the surrogate to terminate her rights to the child at birth and to permit the rearing couple to adopt the child as its own. While surrogate contracts don't appear to be per se illegal, there's at least doubt as to their enforceability of such contracts and thus about the ability of the rearing couple to gain their intended parental rights. Many states have statutes prohibiting baby selling, and it's likely that the payment to a surrogate for her services under contract would violate many of these statutes. Also, at this point, approximately 18 states have adopted laws now which specifically prohibit surrogacy, at least if payment is involved. There are some states that will recognize it as long as no payment is involved. The only state I know of that will recognize it statutorily, at least, and allow compensation is California. For purposes, again, of our discussion, I'd like to look at the Uniform Status of Children of Assisted Conception Act, which was one of your handouts. Again, it's not the law in any state, but it's an example of a statutory solution that might be adopted. That act basically provides for enforcement of a surrogacy agreement if it's approved by the court prior to the date of conception. The statute then goes on and allows the surrogate to terminate the agreement after conception has occurred within 180 days of the last date of insemination, and also, though, allows the compensation of the surrogate. Although there are a number of published cases dealing with surrogacy, none of the cases provide a great deal of guidance for couples contemplating the use of surrogacy in the future, or at least provide them with a great deal of certainty. Some of the cases include a Michigan case in which the state of Michigan acknowledged a fundamental right to make procreative decisions, which includes the right to bear children with the aid of a surrogate. But then the court went on and said that the Michigan baby brokering law would prohibit payment to a surrogate. Contrary result was reached by the Kentucky Supreme Court, which upheld a surrogacy contract in the face of baby selling statutes in Kentucky, and found fundamental differences between surrogate parenting and buying and selling children. And the differences they identified were that in surrogate parenting, the contract is entered into before conception. Arguably, there's less influence on the parties. And secondly, that the primary motivation is not to relieve the burden of child rearing, but to help a couple have a biologically related child. Probably the most well-known case in this area, and the last one we'll look at then, is the Baby M case. The facts, briefly, Mr. Stern, the father, entered into a contract with Mary Beth Whitehead to provide surrogacy services. Mrs. Stern wasn't a party to that contract because of concerns with violation of the New Jersey baby selling statute. Mrs. Whitehead was impregnated by artificial insemination and gave birth to baby M. Subsequently, as provided in the agreement, Mrs. Whitehead surrendered the child, but then immediately thereafter she requested the return of the child because she had indicated she was experiencing some depression and emotional problems. Mr. Stern complied. Mrs. Whitehead then basically absconded with the child, and Mr. Stern brought suit to enforce the surrogacy agreement and terminate Mrs. Whitehead's parental rights. The trial court ruled that the constitutional right of procreation extends to the use of surrogates and found that the agreement was valid and subject to general contract principles, and therefore ordered specific performance of the agreement, terminating Mrs. Whitehead's rights and allowing Mrs. Stern to adopt the baby. Supreme Court didn't accept the trial court's position. It did accept the right of procreation through use of the surrogate, but found that Mr. Stern wasn't deprived of the right of procreation, and went on to state that the care, custody, compensation, and nurturing following the birth are not part of the rights of procreation. The court then went ahead and invalidated the surrogacy contract and voided the adoption by Mrs. Stern and reinstated Mrs. Whitehead's parental rights on the grounds, first of all, that the contract violated the New Jersey adoption statutes with respect to baby selling and the irrevocability of a consent to terminate parental rights, and also the public policy that a child should remain with its natural parents. The court then concluded that the rights of the natural parents should be given equal weight with the best interests of the child being dispositive of custody only. And then looking at the best interests of the child while allowing Mrs. Whitehead to retain her parental rights, placed custody with Mr. Stern. The court did note, however, that it would be willing to enforce a surrogacy contract if payment was not involved and there was a right of the surrogate to change her mind, not dissimilar to the Uniform Act we just discussed. The decision doesn't provide much certainty for parents seeking to use the surrogate process, however, and would certainly leave a decision to use a surrogate open to an awful lot of questions. As I indicated at the outset, with the exception of artificial insemination, there remains a great void with respect to the status of children born through the use of assisted reproductive techniques. As a result, courts are being forced to deal with these issues on a piecemeal basis, and there's very little consistency, very little guidance. However, currently many state legislatures have bills before them dealing with these techniques, and I suppose we can only hope that as time passes, we will have more statutory guidance and a more unified body of case law to deal with these issues in the future. Thank you.
At this time, if one has a question, they're welcome to come to the microphone, and if they'll tell me who they wish to address the question to, we will hand the microphone to them.
I'm Harlan Munz from St. Louis Children's Hospital. I have basically two questions. Preface the first one by this. If the loss of life early in the research of new techniques negates it as ethical, then we'd have to eliminate transplantation, coronary bypass, craniofacial surgery, reconstruction techniques following major cancer surgeries. And but question number one, if the rate of embryo loss approached the 2-3% spontaneous abortion rate, would it then be acceptable? You've also mocked the reported 1% fetal loss in CVS, but if it were true, would it be then similar to the spontaneous abortion rate? And the second one, and this is something that may then be a question that will hit in a lot of pastoral care. If one had a woman who is very prone to miscarriage and previously had frequent miscarriages, would it be then unethical for her to try to have another child, as there is a significantly great risk of the loss of her child?
And to whom would you wish to address this?
Dr.
Rader?
Yeah, why don't you go ahead?
I think you have three questions, is that right? So,
well, basically two. One of whom is that the whole concern about the rate of loss of an embryo in some of these, or of a child in some of these kinds of procedures. You know, what we're talking about is we know that there's a spontaneous rate of abortion about 2 to 4. You quoted 2 to 3%. Therefore, if the rate of miscarriage in any given procedure approached that rate, would you then feel it's an ethical procedure or not?
There's a couple ways to answer that question, and we may not all be in agreement on this, and I respect your right to that, but the problem that I see with the reproductive technologies at the present time is that it seems to me that there is dishonesty in the way the statistics are being reported. For example, I've never seen CVS, and I admit that, because I refuse to work in some of the institutions where these things are being done. But my partner, who was trained in an institution where CVS was common, said to me that it looks like a DNC when you watch that procedure on ultrasound. And they say that there's this reported 2 to 3% miscarriage rate at that gestational age. But that miscarriage rate applies to all comers, including numerous women who've never had an ultrasound exam. And so we don't know the status of those fetuses. But the typical age of miscarriage is 11 weeks. Many, many spontaneous miscarriages are followed by ultrasounds where we've done one or two scans already by that time and know that there was a fetus at 7 to 8 weeks, which lost heart tones then, but pregnancies tend to be carried longer even after the heart tones are lost, and the typical time when the placenta gets the message that the heart tones have stopped is 2 or 3 weeks later, and that's when the lady miscarries. So when they do CVS, they're not going to do CVS on people that are going to miscarry who've already lost those fetal heart tones at 7 to 8 weeks. They're going to say, sorry, lady, you're already miscarrying. So in a sense, they're doing CVS on ladies who already all have fetal heart tones present. And there are other people who say that once fetal heart tones are present, you have better than a 99% survival rate of the fetuses. So when they say their rate of miscarriage is the same as the normal miscarriage rate, you can't really compare those statistics because they're only doing CVS on people who already have heart tones at a late gestational age and would typically not miscarry at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but again, I think the key in that is that what you have is someone who's attempting to reduce the rate of fetal loss by doing research, and so it's I think improper to eliminate that research based off of the fact that there could be early in the stages of research of chance for increased loss. The second question, again, which I think to any of the panelists would be, what would you feel about the woman who then is very prone to miscarriage? Should she then try to conceive?
I don't know what my associates on the panel think, but it seems to me that there's a difference between doctors doing a procedure that may cause death and what I see as God intervening in the normal processes of reproduction. It is true that with normal reproduction, if you start with chemical pregnancies, in other words, where you have HCG measured in the blood, and we know by our chemical tests that pregnancy occurs, there's a 67% spontaneous miscarriage rate starting from the very beginning. It's just enormous, the number of pregnancies that are lost, but it seems to me that there's a difference when there's no intervention, and to me, in God's opinion, for some reason that pregnancy is ended before a baby's born. That to me seems very different from us doing a procedure that may cause the pregnancy to end.
The doctor said it very well, and the fact that a woman may have had previous miscarriages should not in itself negate that she continued to try to seek a pregnancy. In the one flesh union of her husband, that would be a very desirable pursuit, and past miscarriages should not, I don't think, dictate the decision.
Thank you. I wish to warn you all ahead of time. We have to stop right at 10:30.
My name is Paul Shalanko, and I from Richmond, Virginia. I'd like to address my question to Mr. Hurtley, but I would also be interested in the responses of Dr. Shields and Dr. Rader. Dr. Rader, in her discussion on the surgical treatments for infertility, mentioned indigent patients, charity clinics, residency training programs, and the necessity for good educational experience. Now, recognizing that this practice is not limited to her own gynecological specialty, but crosses all medical and surgical subspecialties, would you comment on the ethics of the situation whereby the alleviation of pain, whether it be physical or mental, or the healing process for indigence, appears to be secondary to perceived ulterior motives of good education for possible personal gain in future private practice?
The question has been addressed to me, but I'm not sure that it might not be, nothing like passing the buck, better addressed by one of the ethicists and not a lawyer. I don't know if either of you might be better able to field the question. I honestly, I'm not quite sure I understand.
Well, I would, quite frankly, I addressed the question to you because I wanted to know from a legal point of view the care of the indigent patient and the exploitation, what appears to be the exploitation of the indigent patient.
Okay. Certainly, there is a fair question there. I don't think there's any legal obligation to provide care for the indigent patient outside of, and I'm talking purely from a legal standpoint now, outside of some government benefit. Generally speaking, the reason that indigent patients are required to be afforded care is that the hospital has received a tax exemption and perhaps some government funding. I'm still not quite understanding your question to know how to respond from there.
Well, again, I can only reiterate that my main concern was in the exploitation of indigent patients by residents for so-called good educational experiences, which they could then apply in their own private practices at a future date, not using indigent patients, but for personal gain.
Sure. And I guess my only response can be, from a moral standpoint, I can understand a problem with that legally, unless the process or the care that's afforded would fall below whatever is viewed as the community standard and constitute malpractice. I don't think there's a legal problem with it.
The worth of the individual that we spoke of earlier would therefore speak against a lower level of treatment for the indigent, and any kinds of exploitation would obviously fly in the face of Christian virtue. So there would be a clear case there, I think.
I'd like to make clear that not everything that I report that is happening is such that I'm in agreement with it. And also I'd like to point out that in the sense of competent medical care, I don't really believe that these patients are exploited, because any treatments that are performed for indigent patients, even if they are performed by physicians in training, are always performed with supervising faculty who are there to make sure that the treatment carried out is done properly. And in addition, I think that you should be aware that although residents may be making decisions saying this isn't educationally beneficial to me, they also make those decisions based on whether or not they think it is reasonable and helpful for the patient to be afforded such treatment, and physicians in private practice in fact do the same thing. I make choices with my patients about whom I will treat and about what I will do for them, and in those circumstances, I think I'm sometimes saying to people, I don't think this treatment is in your best interest, even though it is what you want.
Thank you. We have 30 seconds.
Larry Bergdorf, St. Louis. Just wanted to inquire of Mr. Holderly of the status of that bizarre case of the doctor who impregnated scores of women with his own sperm without their knowledge. And has that given rise to any attempts at legislative protection in this area?
I am aware of the case. To my knowledge at this point, I don't believe specifically there's been any specific legislative intent or addressing to address that particular case, though.
Fifteen seconds.
Yes,
pastor
sir.
Can't do it in 15. You know that. One of the things that I think, well, first of all, I want to commend all the panelists. Very thought-provoking. But one of the things that I guess I've been looking for a long time in my ministry is the interdisciplinary approach to these issues. I find as a pastor that I am not asked to be included in staff meetings of my parishioners at a medical institution, as an example, when a life and death issue is being addressed. The chaplain, who does not know that person from a pastoral standpoint, only knows them clinically, is included in that workup, if you will. I probably know my people far better than any of those people do from many perspectives, physically and psychologically and emotionally and spiritually, and I could be a tremendous resource to the medical team. Likewise, in fertility planning or in any of these other things, we touched on it yesterday in a sectional on this, and the answer given was because of the trust level and also because of the lack of probably evenness in training of pastors in these areas, that the medical people are far less trusting of us to be included because we may not know what to do with the information we're given, was the inference. So I don't know if you want to address that or not, the good doctor, pastor, or lawyer.
I agree. I think your input would be very helpful.
A worthy comment and a matter that we'd have to take up with the hospitals, I guess.
We thank our panelists very much, and perhaps this would be an appropriate time to thank them with your applause.